Thanks for tuning in. Happy 4th of July to all my gaucho amigos out there. I know for about a third of you, today is just another Tuesday, but for the majority of listeners, we are standing tough under stars and stripes. This is a Nightfly-centric episode, which feels relevant somehow, I guess, between the 4th, the fact that this week is the anniversary of the start of the International Geophysical Year, which kicked off on July 1st of 1957. And of course, I feel I must pay tribute to that fellow with compassion and vision who's currently programming Twitter. Just some genius decision-making going on behind the scenes there. So I dedicate this episode to him. My guest is Josh Mound. He is a teacher, historian, writer, audiophile, just all around extremely bright guy who I discovered through this amazing writing series he did for the website Audiophile Style. The series is called The Best Version Of. And the basic idea is that he compares different masterings of classic albums, but they go a lot deeper than that. Each column is practically its own 33 and a third book. And I think the one he did for The Nightfly is something like 10,000 words. And it's honestly one of the best pieces of writing that I've read on that album. So, you know, since I'm a huge fan of that album, I invited him to come on the podcast to talk about it. And he did. And you'll see, I kind of let Josh take the wheel on this one, the wheel in space. But I learned a lot. I think you will too. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Josh Mound. Enjoy.
And I remember, you know, my dad had one of those like CD carousel things on the top of our TV stand. And the CD that was always facing forward was The Nightfly. And I had no conception that like this was the guy from Steely Dan. And the cover has that like 50s cover. And I thought it was from the 50s. Like I had no idea it was an 80s album, you know, meant to be stylized like that. And it wasn't until must have been 2000, 2001, like right when I was going to college after the 99 remasters came out and they had that like two disc kind of best of Steely Dan thing that was all the remastered versions and had some of the rarities like FM and stuff on it. My dad got me that for Christmas and it was like driving the 4 hours to college listening to it that it kind of clicked and I got into Steely Dan. So, cool. You know, I was like well into my Steely Dan phase when the like millennial renaissance kind of started, whatever, 10 years ago or so. Yeah. And that was really my introduction to the band and being kind of an audio geek. Once you start into Steely Dan, you just go deeper and deeper because that's such a central part of who they were, is that pursuit of studio perfection. And so you asked about like the series that I write for Audiophile Style and The Best Version Of, which is basically I'll pick an album, I'll write a background of the recording of the album. When possible, like I'll interview engineers and other folks who worked on it. And otherwise it's kind of an archival deep dive into just, you know, old mix magazines and just whatever interviews and things I can find from the artists and from the people who recorded it, and just kind of give, you know, like a 33 and a third style history of recording the album. And then at the end, I analyze all of the digital masterings of that album. So, you know, volume normalize them, run them through some mastering software, see what the objective differences are, and then kind of give my subjective take of which version sounds the best. And that's always like a fun jumping off point then for, you know, other audio nerds to like email me or message on it and argue. It's like, well, I think you're wrong, this one's better because of this reason. And it's a lot more fun thing to argue about than like politics or something like that. So yeah. It's a really, really, really fun series to write. And, you know, two of the first 10 or whatever were Steely Dan related, just because they're kind of such an important artist for me. And because you can't really talk about being an audiophile without talking about Steely Dan. And, you know, as I talked about in this article, particularly The Nightfly is just one of those audiophile reference albums, audiophile audition albums that is inescapable if you go to these sort of audio shows and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is, you know, well known about the Nightfly is it is kind of the album for testing audio equipment, right? For sound guys and I guess audiophiles in general. It sort of has attained this reputation. I mean, you know, the Steely Dan catalog as well, Asia and Gaucho, but I feel like the Nightfly in particular has kind of taken on the reputation of being kind of the album for, like, you know, testing equipment, testing, you know, speakers or you know, for sound guys. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And at the beginning of the article, I kind of run through, spanning from like the 90s up until recently, all of these different, you know, best recordings of all time lists. And the Nightfly is always really high up there and will rank above these, you know, super famous best-selling albums, you know, like Led Zeppelin 4 and Thriller and stuff like that, where you just think, man, how is the Nightfly, which like wasn't really a bestseller, attain this level? And I think that's because, you know, some of these other albums, of course, they're expertly recorded, but it's that combination of popularity and sounding really good, where for the Nightfly, it's that I think everyone, when it came out, thought, wow, this is really setting a new standard. And that's because, you know, one of the first albums that was both recorded digitally and released digitally shortly thereafter, because you have some digitally recorded albums like that start coming out in the late 70s, but they're still released on vinyl and tape. So Nightfly hits like right as the CD is coming out and it's recorded. So you could get this album that was like the whole spectrum is like it's recorded digitally and it's going to be released digitally. And you can kind of experience that pure digital sound, which some people hated, some people loved. And I think that was a big draw. And the imperfections in some ways of the early digital has also made it a successful audiophile audition album. Because when I talked to Elliot Shiner about it, and Elliot Shiner was one of the, you know, engineers for this album and, you know, had this long association with, you know, Donald and Walter. He basically said, you know, these early digital systems, they still only had 16 bits, which is like what CD quality is. And now, you know, people are recording 24 bits, 32 bit float. And so you couldn't record things very soft onto this early digital system because you'd start to get the dither noise, which is like this kind of purposeful noise that's injected into digital recording to kind of get you an extra couple bits, more or less. And in Elliot Shiner's opinion, that made it sound pretty harsh. Like all of the transient hits, like, you know, drum strikes, things like that, are almost piercing at times on things like IGY. But I think that element that he in retrospect in particular says sounds really harsh is also what makes it like a really good audition album, you know, because something that's been recorded to tape that has that nice, pleasing compression, it might not make you notice if like the IEMs or the speakers or whatever you're auditioning has like a something wonky with the treble, you know, where it's like, if you're listening to the Nightfly and it sounds clear and it sounds good, you kind of know that your equipment is rendering it, you know, accurately. And so I think that it's both the strengths and the weaknesses in a way of this early digital technology that make it such an audiophile album.
I think because the Nightfly is kind of coming at that transitional period from analog to digital and from vinyl to CD, something about the kind of maybe blending of the two, or just, you know, kind of like what you were saying, something about it being kind of at the beginning of this digital era, you know, it's in the same way that kind of early rock and roll is kind of the best and purest version of that form. You know, like when we think of what is like the epitome of rock and roll, we think of like Chuck Berry or Elvis, you know, something. The earliest version is still the purest version. And that's kind of how I think about the Nightfly. Like for me, it's still like the gold standard for like, you know, sort of synth driven pop, or, you know, a kind of more digital sounding album, which is what basically, you know, all music is now, you know. It's
yeah. I think kind of what you're hearing, I would attribute to the fact that as digital production goes on, people got better at using its editing abilities. You can see and hear the progression of them leveraging digital tools to kind of excise any minor imperfections, which they were already famous for, right, when they were working on tape and, you know, kind of running the tapes for Gaucho so much that, like, they had to race for some of the tracks to get them mastered before the oxide, you know, shed it off the master tapes. But so they were always pushing that limit. But I think now, you know, I think Two Against Nature was the first Pro Tools album that they did. And, you know, by the time you get to digital, you know, audio workstations, you can minutely edit anything so easily. And Nightfly, yeah, you're still in that transitional period where they've got Wendell, right? They've got engineer Roger Nichols, like early digital drum machine. And they're doing a lot of overdubbing because you can overdub forever and not have degradation the way you do in analog tape. But still, you know, there's the human element of certain things being live takes or being slightly imperfect. And I'm guessing, you know, that's kind of that sweet spot that you're describing, yeah, that you're getting a lot of the benefits of digital, but you still have a lot of the kind of like analog recording methods, because it hadn't advanced to the point where every single microsecond, every single beat you can perfect in a digital audio workstation.
I'm Lester the Ninth Fly. Hello, Baton Rouge. Won't you turn your radio down? Respect the 7 second delay we use. So you say there's a race of men in the trees. You're for tough legislation.
The quip about audiophiles is like that they just like music to audition their equipment. And, you know, there's a certain truth to that. But for me, it's always like, how do you get closer to the music? You know, like a better sounding set of speakers or, better sounding DAC or whatever, you get to hear the music more faithfully, more accurately. And that just kind of necessarily leads to, like, I want to know how this stuff is recorded and I want to know why this album sounds better than that album. And then you just kind of have to go down that rabbit hole of understanding how they were recorded. And then, you know, the reason I started writing the best version of series is there's just wildly different quality levels of a lot of these albums, you know, that there's jillions of masterings of certain major releases, and some of them are atrocious and some of them are amazing. And that's kind of the number one thing where I think even before you start getting into like getting better and better speakers and better headphones or whatever, you're going to notice the difference between like a really like highly compressed, like loudness war mastering of Rumors. There's so many editions of Rumors, right?
Yeah.
There's some that are just like brick walled, sound terrible. And then there's some that are super dynamic and, you know, sound wonderful. And no matter what kind of headphones or whatever you have, like, just I'm wearing a pair of $35 IEMs now that I think are great, right? You're going to notice that huge difference even with some really like budget equipment. And so I think that's kind of, if I'm encouraging people to become audiophiles or to like dip their toe in the water, it starts with start listening to these different versions of albums and like what are your favorite albums. And once you start recognizing like, wow, there's a huge range of how good they can sound just based on what's released, that gets you to start thinking about like how you can kind of maximize your listening pleasure in other ways going forward.
Even with vinyl, even though, you know, it has that, you might have some, you know, imperfections, just because the mastering on that is kind of like the best one that was done, you know, sometimes that's the best option. So like, my favorite version of Asia is the one that my uncle gave me when he gave me his record collection. He bought it in 1977. I haven't ever heard it sound any better than that. So I'm just kind of sticking with that. And maybe there's a better, you know, Super Audio CD or, you know, Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab version of it that is better. But, you know, to me, to my ears, and I don't quite understand the science and the tech behind it, but to me, it just sounds kind of like pure, I guess. But I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm optimistic that Analog Productions is doing these both vinyl and, I'm a digital person, but vinyl and SACD reissues. And so far, the ones that have come out of those have been pretty superb because other than that, right, my favorite version of albums has varied a lot. There's like some kind of Japan only digital releases in the past like 10 years that I'll think are the best one of some albums, and then there's like a Mobile Fidelity CD I'll think is the best of others, and just like the generic 80s, you know, you could have bought at like your Kmart or whatever bin CDs I think are the best of other albums, you know, whether as these analog production ones come out that'll change, I don't know, but it's interesting because, yeah, you can't really always say like the newer one is going to be better or whatever. And I think that was kind of getting to the themes of the Nightfly for that matter, like our bias as Americans, you know, it's like newer is always going to be better. Like we're always advancing in technology. We're always marching forward. And when you kind of get into that kind of archival, you know, digging for the masterings, you realize like, sometimes these old ones actually were the better ones because that was before they started using a lot of compression and started trying to make old albums sound modern and all that kind of stuff. And it's just fun. I mean, for me, I'm sure for some people this like would be pedantic, like, God, how can you listen to like 15 different versions of Rumors and decide which one's the best or whatever. But you get to hear things, even in a bad mastering, sometimes you'll get to hear parts that aren't supposed to be super audible, and maybe that's a flaw, but then you kind of know it's there and you can listen to how it's rendered in different versions, and I think it sort of brings me closer to the music. Like I wouldn't pick an album to listen to for one of my columns that I was going to get sick of listening to all these versions. You know, it's got to be something that I really love and, you know, already have listened to hundreds of times, and so, you know, what's a few hundred more among friends.
Like, how do you choose the albums that you do? Is it just like albums that you personally love, or do you think, is it more from the perspective of this is an interesting album for audiophiles?
I try to kind of get the center of like a Venn diagram of, I really love it, it's an interesting album for audiophiles, I think other people will want to read about it, like it's popular enough and there's enough versions out there to do the technical analysis side of things. So it's kind of the combination of those four things, and I don't always get all four, but that's what I'm shooting for. And the for doing this particular column, you know, I need to have enough different masterings to make that kind of second half of the column work. So there's certainly some albums where it's like, if there's only, you know, one mastering of it, there's no point in doing it. And usually, even if there's only two, there's no point in doing it. But yeah, I want to have like a combination of all of those things. And there are certainly albums that I've done that I think are more like off the beaten path where people aren't as into, or
such as
ones that maybe weren't my favorites, but are ones that I, you know, respect for their audio quality and respect them and sort of the world of audiophiledom.
Which ones were those?
Okay, so I did like Pharoah Sanders, Karma, which I love personally.
That was a personal favorite,
Yeah, there's not a ton of masterings of, but he had just passed away. I felt like this is an album more people should listen to. So I did that one, even though it didn't necessarily hit like all four of those things. And then there are other, you know, John Martin, Solid Air, not incredibly popular, right? And I don't know how many people would say like this is an audiophile album, but I definitely felt so. Where other ones, like I did Cat Stevens' Tea for the Tiller Man, which probably checks all four. Okay. I think, right? Like,
got it.
Everyone sort of loves that album. It's a bestseller, you know. It might not check is like the audiophile element of it. Yeah. So I kind of, you know, different ones, I see like what's going to fit all of those things. But I mean, Steely Dan ones, big Kate Bush's Hounds of Love, Peter Gabriel. So like, those are albums that slam dunk kind of hit all four of those. Like they've been released a ton of times. They're really popular. Everyone agrees they're audiophile masterpieces, and I personally love them.
It's fun. I mean, the Nightfly seems like it would be really in your, you know, at the nexus of your interest points, because, I mean, not only is it one of the kind of quintessential audiophile albums, it's also, there's a lot about history, right? And you're a history professor, so You know, songs like The New Frontier and I guess even IGY and or The Goodbye Look, there's a historical and even political component to The Nightfly that, again, I feel like is less present on Steely Dan albums. Is that part of the appeal of The Nightfly for you, would you say, or no?
I think unintentionally in a way. Yeah. I when I first heard it, I wasn't even necessarily thinking of it in that context. I mean, that was almost, I think, before I decided to go into history. You know, in high school, I hated history. I never would have thought I was going to get a history PhD.
Really?
And then I came to a different appreciation of it later as I understood the context that it was, you know, the context of like young Donald Fagen and what he was experiencing growing up and how that found its way into the album. And I think what's interesting to me about it too is that it's probably hard for modern listeners to like comprehend what that optimism of the post-war era felt like, because, you know, we're just so awash in cynicism and disappointment, and, you know, in an era where like Elon Musk, you know, wrecking Twitter and exploding rockets and killing test monkeys and things like that. You know, we're sort of used to like these over promises of technology and then being really disappointed, like self-driving cars are going to change everything. And like, we're just all just going to be able to take a nap in our commute. And oh, by the way, it might like run you into a concrete barrier and kill you. You know, I mean, like, we're just kind of used to like this PR buildup and then this horrible reality. And I think that that wasn't so much the case in this post-war era, where it was common to hear and see otherwise like respectable people making these, in retrospect, just like outlandish predictions of how wonderful things were going to be in the not too distant future. And The Nightfly really captures that. And I think an interesting thing, if you read interviews with Fagen, is, you know, he says that this is kind of like his anti-irony album, that, you know, all of the Steely Dan stuff was just like dripping with irony. And I think in one sense, he's right. Like there are tender moments on The Nightfly, and because it's filtered through his childhood perceptions, there's bound to be kind of like a Wonder Years haze to certain elements of it. But I think actually there's a meta level irony, right? If irony is like the distance between the expectation and the reality, the whole context of the album is about the distance between the expectation of what life was going to be like in the 1980s from the view of the 50s and what the 1980s were really like. And so we kind of take it for granted that of course things were going to be disappointing. Of course things were going to turn out to be this, you know, high inequality, you know, shipping like manufacturing overseas to sweatshops, all these kind of things, right? We were never going to get the 30-hour, let alone 20-hour work week. That seems just like obvious. But if you were growing up in the 50s and reading like mainstream publications, these were the predictions that were being made. And the album really captures that well, captures that optimism that seems super naive to us in retrospect, but was very, very authentic and very genuine at the time it was made.
You know, I grew up mostly in the 90s. I was born in 85, and I feel like there was kind of a little bit of sort of techno optimism during that time, some of the like the dot-com era and the idea that the internet was going to kind of like democratize everything in a way. And I feel like, you know, nobody's written the IGY of that yet. I mean, maybe Donald at some point, but I feel like we're living through a similar time where, you know, 30 years prior during the 90s, there was all this techno optimism that has kind of curdled into something like dark and sinister. So I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely true. And I would really say like, it's, you have that letdown of the 80s, but you know, from my perspective, it's really all of that post.com stuff that we've just lived through. One failure of techno utopianism after another, really, since then, that now when you hear, I mean, obviously Elon has his fans, and there are people who believe every word that that he says of what's going to take place or what any company, you know, or any executive says they're going to be able to achieve. But for the most part, I think we're all very cynical now. And that understanding that, you know, corporations lie, rich people lie, this is just what they do. You know, we're all steeped in that where I think they're thinking about like Walter versus Donald. I've often wondered, like, could Walter have even been really a part of a project like the Nightfly? Because it would also be wrong to say like everyone in the 50s bought that optimism. You know, we look back at that time period through this idealism and that he's purposely channeling on that album. And I know he's really aware of, you had, you know, massive segregation, like working class people weren't doing super well. Poor people weren't doing super well in the 50s and 60s. But, you know, for kind of like the middle class suburban families that he was a part of and that he's, you know, specifically said he was writing about for this album, I think it would have been really easy to read like it was, I think Fortune magazine had this like whole series that became a book that was called like The Fabulous Future. And it was in mid 50s, it came out and it was predicting the world of 1980. And it was like, we're going to have nuclear batteries and every house is going to have like its own mini nuclear generator. And we're going to have cured cancer and we're going to have a 30-hour work week and we're going to have free energy. I mean, there was like, this is literally the stuff. It was the head of RCA, the CEO of RCA is like, was the curator of this series. And it wasn't the only publication. Like you could find like, you know, all kinds of mainstream outlets were just like saying that we were going to be achieving all of this amazing stuff just in a few decades, let alone by the year 2000. And I think if you were someone, you know, who experienced this explosion of prosperity relative to the Great Depression right after World War II, you might have felt like, oh yeah, we've achieved all this stuff. We won World War II. We did all these like amazing things. Maybe we're actually going to get to this point. And, you know, the Nightfly is kind of reminding us from the vantage point of the 80s of like, look at all this absurd stuff people were predicting back then. And we were a bunch of chumps who bought it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, that's very relevant today because it's hard not to feel like a chump right now. I think when it comes to like the average person's relationship with kind of, you know, corporations and technology today, where, you know, we feel like things aren't being harnessed for our benefit. You know, we're not, no one I think really expects like AI is going to get us a 30-hour work week or whatever. I mean, AI is going to probably get us like more inequality and all the stuff that we've gotten from all the other previous technological innovations that were supposed to deliver utopia, but instead just kind of delivered a new, you know, hyper competitive form of capitalism that immiserates a lot of average people.
Yeah, I think that should be the next Fagan solo album, should be some sort of AI driven concept album. I think that would be,
yeah, I would go for that. Yeah.
And that'd be perfect for his, you know, the sensibility that we've seen on his solo albums. Plus, you know, it would speak to our current moment.
The Nightfly kind of hit at this sweet spot where it was recorded just before the CD debuted. So it became this album that you could buy that was both recorded digitally and that you could listen to digitally. So it was sort of like end-to-end digital. Whereas, you know, a lot of the other big kind of early CD albums like Born in the USA and stuff like that, you know, were recorded to tape. And so, yeah, you got the benefit as a consumer of not having like the hiss and the crackle of tape, you know, cassette tapes or vinyl, But it still was recorded to tape. So for people who wanted to hear, like, what does all digital sound like? The Nightfly really became one of the first albums that you could have that experience.
And it was going to be one of the first CDs released, right? One of the first albums released.
It was CD. Supposed to be one of the first CDs released. And the weird story there is, there are all kinds of bizarre Steely Dan tape release snafus, you know, stories. For this one, for Nightfly, they made like a safety copy, I believed, to analog tape. And the record label mistakenly sent that analog tape out to be transferred to digital tape to be transferred to CD instead of just taking the original digital tape and sending it out to be transferred to CD. So they kind of inserted this unnecessary analog step in the process. And the story, which sounds just unbelievable, but that Stevie Wonder got a copy of the early Nightfly CD and called Roger Nichols and said, something doesn't sound right about this. So Roger Nichols goes to the store, buys the CD, and he's like, yeah, something doesn't sound right about it. So he investigates and finds out that they accidentally sent this analog safety copy rather than the actual digital tape to get pressed to CD. So there's I was able to track one down for my column. And yeah, the difference is minuscule, right? But you can tell. And if you look at it like in you know, some audio software, it's really obvious that there are differences, but they're not big differences. So I mean, you just have to be amazed at the abilities of someone like Stevie Wonder or Roger Nichols, you know, and I'm sure Donald and Walter, right, to hear these just infinitesimally small differences of just inserting one generation of analog tape into this process. And so yeah, you can still, if you look for it, and I talk about how to identify it in my article, you can find that version that has that analog generation in it.
Yep.
But they kind of pulled those off the market and then made sure it was like end-to-end digital CDs from that point out.
You know, one thing I love about the Nightfly in terms of the sound of it is also just the synthesizer sound on it is like great. And I don't know, you know, in general, I love the sound of those earlier, those early synths that were being made in the 80s. And I know they've kind of come back into fashion where people will pay a lot of money to get some of those, you know, older, you know, kind of vintage synthesizers. So, I mean, do you know, the synergy? It looks like there were fewer than 1,000 ever made. Do you know much?
Yeah, you know, and because it's interesting that Donald has this like history of like love hate with synthesizers, where I can't remember, was Royal Scam or what album that they famously like set an ARP synthesizer on fire and like threw it off the roof of the recording studio because they got so frustrated with it. And
that was for Countdown to Ecstasy, I think.
Countdown to Ecstasy, yeah. And you know, I think that it's interesting that he introduces synths on this album, given that kind of problematic history. But really, you know, after this, there's synth keyboards kind of on all of his stuff to a certain extent after that. And I think, you know, he was in the Yamaha, like that famous Yamaha poster for Yamaha synthesizers. That's like this bizarre Donald Fagen photo of like him shot through a window outside the house, like you're leering in at Donald Fagen practicing.
It's like a horror movie poster.
Yeah, it's a really bizarre, you know, Friday the 13th advertisement for Yamaha synths. But yeah, I think that they really do. They sound, it's a lush, nice sound. And it has come back into fashion, and that is one of the reasons why I think, you know, you mentioned earlier about like that the Nightfly doesn't actually sound that dated, doesn't sound that 80s. And I think that's because a lot of these sounds have had a renaissance that I think from the time I first listened to the Nightfly, it's to now, it sounds more contemporary now than it did then, because I associated kind of like, you know, early 2000s, a lot of those sounds still seemed really 80s, really dated. And now we've had this kind of 80s revival where a lot of those sounds that seem 80s now seem contemporary again.
That's true.
And I think just, you know, it never, even when it sounded more dated, it never veered into cringe territory, in my opinion. Like, they used the synthesizers, I think, pretty artfully, and the levels they are in the mix and the particular settings they used. And I've read, you know, different times when Donald's talked about what he does with synthesizers to make them sound fresh to his ears. You know, we'll put them through like a light phaser or do some things kind of after the fact where you're just tweaking the synth sound just a little bit so it doesn't sound exactly like the preset on the keyboard. And I think that also really helps both on the Nightfly and on subsequent albums, kind of the use of some of the keyboards that they could sound very stale and kind of cringy actually end up sounding very, you know, warm and inviting. And particularly for the Nightfly, just kind of set this like sonic wash kind of background to everything, you know, like at the beginning of, you know, IGY, that just really is inviting and kind of brings you into this sonic world of the album right away.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think even within the like Steely Dan and Donald and Walter kind of repertoire, I feel like in recent years, two albums that have kind of gained in stature in their reputation are Gaucho and The Nightfly, because I think, you know, like you said, that kind of 80s synth-driven sound has kind of come back into fashion. And those are two albums that, you know, did it, you know, they were among the kind of the earliest to do it, and they did it so well. So it's possible that they were so ahead of their time when they were released that, you know, because Gaucho kind of, I mean, The Nightfly got, you know, critically acclaimed, but I think Gaucho, the reviews were more mixed. But in recent years, we've seen a sort of critical reappraisal of Gaucho, I think.
It's really amazing to me that Gaucho was like panned by so many people when it came out, because I've always thought it was an amazing album. And
it's crazy.
I also think part of it was they weren't really out around the two promote it that much, and it seemed like the kind of fraught process of creating it soured their own perspectives on the album, and so it just, you know, it didn't really get a lot of love either from, you know, Walter and Donald themselves or from reviewers, and that just kind of made it like unfairly maligned, where I mean, I think Gaucho's a masterpiece, and in a lot of ways I think that Gaucho and Nightfly go together thematically, because, you know, so much of Gaucho was about the disappointments of the 60s, right? Like from the vantage point of the 70s, and the 60s, not meaning like the new frontier 60s of the Nightfly, but like what we think of as kind of like the post-Kennedy kind of like hippie, right? New left sort of 60s, that the belief in kind of this individual like liberation and kind of social progress that everyone felt was building with all of these social movements in the late 60s, you get to the 70s and a lot of it for one reason or another just falls apart, either through just, you know, internal strife or through, you know, this very organized backlash from conservatism to that social movement, you know, progressive social movement era of the 60s. And so, you know, kind of Gaucho was dealing with like, how do you exist in the 70s hangover? And, you know, are you left being, you know, the guy in Hey 19 where you're like still trying to party and hang out, and it makes you feel like you're old, you know? And so I think on the one hand, you know, and in some ways like Gaucho was addressing the interpersonal elements of that and that kind of age of cynicism and you know, culture of narcissism, you know, like the famous Christopher Lash book that Jimmy Carter loved, and I have to imagine Donald and Walter were at least familiar with, right, that you can really see that type of social criticism like suffused throughout Gaucho, where Nightfly then just kind of takes a step further back, where we're looking at, you know, the new frontier 60s and you know, the Eisenhower 50s, and what does that look like now in retrospect? And a lot of that I think ends up being more criticisms of like larger social and political structures. You know, a lot of Gaucho is more interpersonal, where a lot of Nightfly, even if it's, you know, talking about like having a wingding in a bomb shelter, you know, it's still like hinting at these larger kind of social and political forces. And so I think sagonically those two go together, thematically they go together, because they're both just kind of dealing with the disappointment that ended up coming out of this era. Yes, we're gonna have a wingding. Summer smoke around the ground. It's just a dugout that my dad built. In case the rest decide to push the button down. The story that Roger Nichols had talked a little bit about in interviews, and then you know, Roger's daughter Simsy had done a bunch of interviews with Roger and you know, sent me some of the interviews with her dad that were talking about the Nightfly for this article, and he kind of expanded upon it there, which is that basically they did this like ABC showdown where like A was the band playing live in the studio, B was that recording coming off of tape, and C was that recording coming off of digital. And so basically they could toggle back and forth between the sound coming live from the studio, the sound coming off of the analog tape, and the sound coming off of the digital machine. And that's actually how they decided to record it in digital, is that they felt like the digital recording sounded more like the band playing live in the studio than the analog tape did. And so that, you know, that's how they made that decision, and that's how it became a digital recording.
Oh, wow.
And it's interesting in retrospect too, if you think kind of the sonic history of Steely Dan, that they're kind of, you know, we're starting to inch towards digital with Wendell being a digital drum machine. And Roger Nichols talked about that they considered digital briefly, at the time of recording Gaucho, but that the machines that were around at that point in time, they felt like kind of weren't up to snuff yet. And so then you get digital on this 3M machine for Gaucho. They use the 3M machine again for Kamakiriad. And then, right, they go to Pro Tools Digital for Two Against Nature. But then kind of what happens after they start working solely with Elliot Shiner is Elliot Shiner sets up his own kind of A-B test of analog versus digital before they recorded Everything Must Go. And by that point,
oh yeah,
they chose to go back to analog.
Interesting.
And I think that kind of culturally is also interesting. It's almost like a mini recitation of the optimism, techno-optimism he's talking about.
Wow.
In the Nightfly, and then let down after the fact that like they believed digital was going to be this like savior for them. Yeah. But then, you know, after the fact, they're like, maybe actually the analog ended up sounding better. And that's also what part of, I think, makes Steely Dan interesting to audiophiles, and this album interesting to audiophiles, is there's, you know, heated debates among audiophiles about analog versus digital. And even among recording artists, you know, there's some artists who insist today on recording to analog. You know, Wilco is really famous that like they just record to analog, they kind of dipped their toe into digital with Summer Teeth and then went back to analog. And even like Radiohead, they track everything to digital, but then they dump it to analog to get that analog compression, so that they want that analog stage that Stevie Wonder and Roger Nichols thought was undesirable for the Nightfly. And that debate is just like a microcosm about this technological utopianism versus disappointment that is talked about on kind of a larger level with the Nightfly, just in terms of like the recording history of Steely Dan, where it's like, is digital kind of the savior of audio, or is it this, you know, cold, sterile, horrible invention?
You know, as I'm doing the Twitter account, you know, one thing that, you know, I'm very happy to see is how many, you know, younger people are getting into Steely Dan, and how much of that, you know, it's a lot of it is, you know, the younger millennial or even Gen Z driving this kind of Steely Dan renaissance. But occasionally I see things like people listening to Steely Dan on their iPhones or listening on their laptops. And that kind of kills me because, you know, I'm not expecting everyone to have like, you know, a top notch audiophile setup, but to listen to Steely Dan on your iPhone, I don't, how do you feel about that?
I'm not a kind of like snob audiophile in that way. Like,
okay.
I mean, part of it is, you know, I'm kind of a class warrior in my politics. Come from more of like a, you know, blue collar background.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't think you need like Henry Rollins, like $250,000 speakers, right, to appreciate the audio quality of music.
What advice would you give to a kind of burgeoning Steely Dan fan if they didn't have a deep wallet?
I've just recently wrote like an under $50 like IEM matchup, and I'm writing a second one. And you know, like I said, the pair that I'm wearing now to do this interview, they're $35, and I think they're really good. Can you buy better IEMs? Absolutely, but it's not like a linear price to quality thing. I think it's also worth guarding against going too far in the other extreme. Like, there are certain audio websites that make it seem like every piece of more expensive audio equipment is a scam, and like that these companies are like selling snake oil and fooling people. And yeah, I mean, there are companies that sell like $1,000 power cables and stuff that, to me, it's just like, this is totally absurd. Like, you can't, I can't imagine hearing a difference from any of this. And when I've tried to, you know, like borrow things like that and hear a difference, I haven't. But, you know, there's generally good, you know, good companies that know what they're doing. If you give them more money, they're going to make a better piece of equipment, but they're sort of like diminishing returns. I think like anything, if you buy the right $35 pair of IEMs, it might take till you spend $200 and you're picking the right $200 pair till you're actually hearing a difference. Right. There's not, you know, a clear one-to-one, like if you spend more money, it's going to sound better. I mean, there are $1,000 IEMs that sound like garbage, in my opinion. And I'd take the $35 IEMs over them any day of the week. And so I really think that it's more for like younger people. I want them to become audiophiles. Like, I don't want being an audiophile to be this exclusive thing,
right,
that you need to know all of the terminology and you have to have a deep wallet. Like, I think you can get into being an audiophile at any budget, and a $35 pair of IEMs and like a $20 like lightning to USB or lightning to 1/8 jack dongle on your iPhone or whatever, you're going to have much better sound quality than even using like AirPods or something like that. Yeah, so it was the new Musical Express, Richard Cook, asked Fagan in 1983, which of the fantasies captured by the Nightfly had come closest to being realized. And he said, Fagan said, quote, "I guess the recording studio, from a purely technological handle, reflects my interest from that time. It's very high tech and you have all these machines to play with. That's how I imagine life to be. But I guess most of them just dried up." Right, that I think that's to me a really cool thing about, like, if you're thinking of the meta levels of the Nightfly, that it's the first digital album. It's, you know, this huge studio production. I think its budget was even bigger than Gaucho's, right? And that it's amazing that Fagan is in this kind of technological utopia kind of cocoon of the studio, singing about how all of these like predicted technological utopias didn't actually come to fruition. And, you know, but he's cognizant of the fact that like part of what's the part of the attraction for the studio for him is that it is kind of what he was expecting life to be like, you know, based on reading this sci-fi and this futurism and stuff of the 50s. And most of it didn't come to be, but actually audio technology kind of did keep on getting better and better.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's just kind of a cool, I think, perspective on the album. If you're thinking of the different angles of, you know, him thinking of his younger self, thinking of the future and his present self and what the future was actually like. And that he did realize like a small part of this with becoming this, you know, studio perfectionist. And you asked me about, you know, part of the appeal of being an audiophile, I think, is it's an element of technology that I think, you know, is relatively unproblematic and that you can just kind of enjoy and that you can kind of nerd out on the technology and appreciate it. And, you know, it's not worrying that, yeah, your self-driving car is going to drive you into a barrier, that, you know, you're not trusting Elon Musk to like put a chip in your brain that's killing lab monkeys or whatever. Like, you can just feel like, oh yeah, you know, I can learn all about all this audio technology and all of this music is now at my fingertips and I can get really good sounding equipment for relatively modest sums today. Music in it, just like, you know, he talked about that was like the outlet for him in a kind of dull Cold War 1950s existence. I think for a lot of audiophiles, and definitely for me, like the combination of the music and the audio equipment is kind of an outlet for, you know, whatever disappointment you have about the world at large. You can kind of escape to this fantasy land of, you know, audio and music and have this reprieve from what might be a depressingly dystopian real world right now.
Mount Belzoni.